2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today, January 10th, 2010, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on this lovely winter day. Our guest today is one of the leading bloggers, for lack of a better term, on the internet, the proprietor of the TomDispatch.com website, a longtime editor and writer, author of the book The End of Victory Culture and of a novel, The Last Day of Publishing, one of the most interesting writers on U.S. foreign policy going today, someone who's going to be a wonderful guest. I'm looking forward to having him. Tom Engelhart will be with us today, but before we get to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
As more people watch online TV or consider cutting the cord to their cable service, cable companies are getting nervous and attempting to stifle the competition. Last month, Comcast launched its Fancast Xfinity service that gives its subscribers exclusive access to some of its video content online. Xfinity is part of an industry-wide scheme called TV Everywhere, which will put premium TV content only in the hands of those who subscribe to both video and broadband services of a cable, phone, or satellite company. Industry officials are touting TV Everywhere as a great new service for consumers, but Marvin Amore, a law professor at the University of Nebraska and senior advisor to Free Press, says that the industry is actually trying to kill online TV to make sure people keep paying their monthly cable subscriptions.
TV Everywhere is a system to ensure that programmers don't make their TV shows and films available on the internet except to people who've already paid for a cable subscription. As a result, the internet can't be a place for competitors to offer their shows and programming so that people can choose internet services over cable TV service. Under TV Everywhere, you have to pay for both. You have to pay for a cable subscription and an internet subscription to watch this content over the internet.
Amore has written a paper, TV Competition Nowhere, How the Cable Industry is Colluding to Kill Online TV. Amore says that this is a textbook case of an antitrust violation because the companies are colluding with each other to squash competition.
Collusion is sort of the opposite of competition. In our country, we believe in competition leading to lower prices, more choices for consumers, and innovation. We have a strong policy against competitors, you know, getting together into a room and deciding how to set prices without competing against one another and keep prices high for consumers, how to allocate markets so that one competitor takes one market and another competitor takes another. Allocating markets, setting prices, this is referred to in competition law as collusion, getting together, not competing, but making agreements to hurt consumers.
Consumer groups, including Free Press, have called on federal antitrust authorities and Congress to investigate TV Everywhere to make sure that the dominant media companies don't turn the open, innovative internet into a mirror image of the walled-off, exclusive world of cable TV. To read TV Competition Nowhere by Marvin Amore, go to freepress.net.
And now, media reformers offer their wishes for 2010.
I'm Casey Ray Hunter from Future of Music Coalition, and here's my wish list for 2010. I want meaningful net neutrality rules so that the internet remains a platform for innovation, entrepreneurship, creativity, and commerce for everybody and not just the big power players. I want a more competitive and robust wireless broadband marketplace with net neutrality as part of the entire mobile experience. And ultimately, I think there needs to be a greater recognition by policymakers about the value of the American creative sector. We're a huge part of the economy, and we're a vital part of the country's culture, and we got to put the focus on sustainable local cultural communities as a way to reinvigorate our struggling towns and cities. We can pull together on this, but to do so, we got to make our leaders aware that this is a crucial part of American recovery.
Hello, this is Tracy Van Slyke from the Media Consortium, and my wish for 2010 is that journalism organizations and funders invest in innovation and experimentation for journalism organizations. This means that journalism organizations can start experimenting with new journalism models, new revenue-generating models that can help them reach new kinds of communities, really push forth new kinds of journalism production, and find new ways for long-term sustainability. I also wish that journalism organizations find and build bridges and relationships with ethnic media and different kinds of bloggers and journalists, diversity, people of color, women. This is very important to the future of the kind of journalism we want to produce and democracy for our country.
My name is Hannah Miller, and I work for the Media and Democracy Coalition. And I wish for affordable, high-speed internet service to be a utility like light or water. I also wish that the Local Community Radio Act be passed, so may 1,000 low-power FM stations bloom. I wish that the FCC would make the internet a discrimination-free zone.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have as our guest today, as I said at the outset, Tom Engelhardt, who runs the TomDispatch.com website, or helps run it. He's the creator of it, author of many books, and a longtime active editor at Pantheon Books. For many years, active as a writer and a journalist. Tom Engelhardt, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, Bob.
It's great to have you here. And one of the pleasures of preparing for this show is going through the archives of TomDispatch.com and reading the pieces in it. And for listeners unfamiliar with TomDispatch.com on the website, it is not like many websites that cover politics that have sort of short opinion pieces, which are always entertaining, or columns, or just sort of quickie dispatches, but features many long, well-researched pieces, but I would say very accessible also. So it's a pleasure to read. Tom, before we get started, why don't you talk a little bit about how you started your website, why you started the web page, and what it does.
Sure. Well, you know, it was total happenstance in my life. I mean, I suppose what I first have to say is that although you spoke of me as a journalist, I never identify myself as a journalist. In what still passes for real life for me, I've been a book editor in mainstream publishing for many, many years. I do a series now called The American Empire Project for Metropolitan Books. And but after 9/11, I lived in New York. I've always been a news junkie all my life, and I was appalled by the coverage, which got narrower and narrower, and you might say more nationalistic. And I had a very, for a guy who thinks of himself as reasonably politically sophisticated, I had a very naive reaction to 9/11. It happened in my city, and I thought somehow it would open us up to some extent to the world, to the kind of pain that goes on elsewhere in the world. And after months of seeing, you know, those repetitive rights in ballparks and everywhere else where we were the greatest victims, survivors, dominators, and the only role left on earth was greatest evil one, I did have the urge to do something, although no idea what. And one day, I was very new. I had email, but I was very new to the internet. I didn't even really grasp you could run around the world reading things. This was 2001. I saw a piece by an Afghan guy who was living in California. It was a very prophetic piece. It was against going into Afghanistan. He was very anti-Taliban and so on and so forth, but there was an image in it, and the image was, he said that what does it mean, because our bombing campaign had just started, October 2000, what does it mean to stir the rubble, for bombs to stir the rubble? And I thought, because of course Afghanistan was already wrecked when we went into it by the previous war we had been involved in and what had happened afterwards. And I took that piece. I was stunned by it. I just thought, you can't read anything like this. I made a little list of friends, you know, 12 friends. I sent it out. I said, you have to read this. And that really was the beginning of Tom Dispatch. It was a no-name email site. I started wandering the web looking for other voices than what you could read here. And I began piling pieces up and writing little commentaries, and people started asking simply to get on this list. I didn't even know what I was doing. And at some point, Ham Fish, the list got bigger and bigger, and the things got more elaborate, and at some point, Ham Fish of the Nation Institute said, hey, you know, how about if we support this and put this up as a website? I hadn't even thought of it. So I had already started this other kind of intervention, this American Empire series. I just wanted to do something. And I said, okay. And I started asking friends, you know, people I had published over the years, like, say, Chalmers Johnson or Mike Clare, to write for me. You know, it was kind of a little community activity, a freebie activity. And the thing turned into, I mean, I would say it's probably the odyssey of my later life. I'm an old guy. I'm 65. And so it has a lot of old habits. I'm a manic editor, so everything, I hope, is a well-made essay. It does what the president, you know, what the president said the other day about the intelligence community should do. It tries to connect the dots for people. It's kind of providing frameworks. That's the way I see it, anyway. And it's three well-made pieces a week. There's no chatter at Tom Dispatch. People write me privately, but I don't much like the online yakking that goes on, and I don't have it at my site. It's kind of old-fashioned that way a little bit, but the material, I think, is pretty leading edge.
Well, I would say also for people who go to the TomDispatch.com site and go down the list of authors who are regular contributors and start reading some of them, it's a distinguished group of people who know what they're talking about. Many experts, yeah, on the areas.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing I'd say that you alluded to, you just mentioned, which is striking about your website compared to other websites and regrettably too many books, is that it's edited.
Yeah.
And editing is something, it's sort of something that's expensive to do, relatively speaking, and so it's something that's not done, it's difficult to do.
Yeah. It's also expensive of time. I mean, the truth is, I have a very complicated life because everything is edited. Tom Dispatch takes a lot of time. It's a shoestring operation. Really, the Nation Institute supports it, but I kind of lead a second life as an editor. And as you know from your own writings, this is not, you know, the internet is not, on the whole, a very profitable place. And editing is time-consuming, but it's what I've done all my life. Writing's been a kind of a secondary thing for me. It's what I've kind of done on the side. And so I can't imagine putting out not well-edited and hopefully well-copy-edited and reasonably well-proofed pieces about, you know, my, really, the site largely sticks to my obsessions, which are the Pentagon, militarism, foreign policy, particularly our wars, the Greater Middle East, South Asia, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's in a way, it was the Bush administration and the global war on terror, which has just carried over into the Obama administration, which is largely, if you think about it in foreign policy terms, the Obama administration is Bush administration 2 in the literal sense that it's the late Bush, the post-Cheney Bush administration, too, and not surprising because, of course, the key person in the administration is Robert Gates, who's a holdover. So,
our guest today, Tom Engelhart, you've just been listening to, the head of the TomDispatch.com website, author and editor. If you'd like to call in and talk with Tom, the number here at WILL-AM580, 333-9455, toll-free is 1-800-222-9455. The website concentrates, if you're not familiar with it, on international affairs, issues of war and peace, politics in general. We're going to be talking about all those issues today, in particular Afghanistan and the war on terror. But I just want to finish up on this question of editing, because as you were talking about it, it occurred to me as a writer that many of our listeners who are readers, I hope, are unfamiliar really with the role editors play, not just with books, but also with magazine articles and what editing brings to the picture. I think anyone who writes and knows this, you know, something you don't even need to be told about, how important it is to have an editor. But maybe for the layperson who's unfamiliar with what you do and have done for your career, how much does an editor just sort of change a word here and there? What does good editing entail?
In the book world, good editing probably starts from the first moment that somebody thinks of and proposes a piece. I mean, I'm a handholder in a way. Yeah, I mean, think of it this way. An editor is like a therapist, but only in the sense, not directly in the sense of another person. I get inside the skin of a manuscript, and I don't try to do what I would want to do to it. I try and figure out what the author would have done if, as happens with all writers, you don't end up in a series of cul-de-sacs and get knotted up in various ways. So I try and create paths for the writer, you might say, to do what he or she wanted to do but didn't quite get. They didn't quite get that far, you might say. I think editing generally, I mean, again, this is a little off our subject for today, but I think it really has to do with property rights. That is, the question is who owns the space in which you edit. And the difference between the kind of editing I've done all my life, which is books and newspapers and magazines, is until recently, it was always accepted that the space between the covers and publishing, between the book covers, was the author's. And that makes for a very different kind of editing than in magazines or newspapers, where that space is the space of the newspaper, the magazine, mm-hmm. the person who owns it. So it's a different kind of editing.
Is editing dying as a result of commercial pressures, do you think?
There's no way of knowing that. It's funny. Editing is such a secretive activity in a way. I mean, editors are really behind the scenes. It's hard for me to tell, just in the world I know well, which is the book world, you know, just how much less editing may be being done now. I suspect that there's somewhat less, yes. But I don't know about dying. You know, I mean, all it takes is one person who's manic about these things, and you get an edited book. So.
I guess outside of the book world, though, so I go online and I surf the web looking at sites.
Oh, well, on the web, yes.
I see website after website with oftentimes very interesting material, but the writing is entirely unedited.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's so little editing generally that goes on the web. I mean, if you're off newspaper sites or whatever, you know, I mean, if you're on smaller sites, I mean, it's understandable. People are writing, particularly when you're on blogs where people are just writing, they have no one to look. The problem is, as a writer, I know this all the time, once you've written something and it's there, you know, you always tend to read over your own mistakes. Mm-hmm. I often tell young writers, for instance, one quick way to edit your own stuff is to read aloud. We're so unused to reading aloud that it sounds alien. It gives you a little distance and you start to hear mistakes you've made. But I do it all the time. Even when copy editors send me mistakes on my material, often it's hard for me to find the mistakes because it's hard to see them. So if you have people who are writing blogs every day, no matter how hard they try, if no one else is copy editing them or editing them, they're just going to make lots of mistakes. There's no way around it. You know, as they used to say about nuclear plants when they went down, human error.
No, that's true. And as a writer, I know that, even the finest stuff I think I've written, after it goes through an editor, it comes up with stuff I hadn't seen that makes it infinitely better as a result.
Absolutely.
Let's go to our phone lines now. Our guest today is Tom Engelhardt from TomDispatch.com. We're going to be talking about the national security state, militarism, the war in Afghanistan, issues of war and peace, and the state of this country, which is the subject of TomDispatch.com. The number here is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller now, line one, Rantoul, you're on the air.
Hello, I have a statement and a question, and the statement is, I'm not an editor myself, but we have some grossly underpaid, excellent editors where I work, and I, for one, understand how they can turn a manuscript from something that's hard to read and poorly understood into crystal clear pleasure to read. So I understand the value of editing. And my question is, your blog sounds great, but what is it? I've never heard of it before. Is it kind of lost in the shuffle of the humongous number of sites on the web? Thanks. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Let me say something about the statement and then answer your question. The one thing I would say about editing is, despite what people think, that the best editing is done on the worst manuscripts, it's actually not true. The best editing is done on the best manuscripts. The best writers, the best manuscripts, that's the best kind of editing. Now, I mean, it would take another conversation to explain that. But, I mean, yes, I've had to resuscitate terrible manuscripts, but the great editing is done on wonderful manuscripts. And that's an odd thing, but it's true. Anyway, No, actually, as far as the website, it's kind of, you know, it's small in itself. It's basically me. I've got a couple of part-time assistants, but it's a kind of a launching pad. It's a kind of a freebie launch. You know, it goes all over the internet. I mean, it's picked up by Alternet, AntiWar.com. I sold a million reasonably big websites. Salon.com uses it. Asia Times. I sold a piece, my last piece, which was a piece by Orville Schell on how this country turned from a can-do to a can't-do country. I sold that to the LA Times op-ed page. It runs around. So Tom Dispatch stuff is out there. There's no way of knowing the figures. I kind of estimate that maybe 100,000 people read every piece, but there's really no way. It's so hard to tell online. I mean, you just can't count, basically. It's my guess.
And your revenue stream is basically the... revenue puddle is what the Nation gives you, the Nation Institute, and then maybe if you sell a piece, the few dollars that might generate.
And contributions online from readers who love it. I mean, I do get surprising contributions, which we use to, you know, I pay modestly, very, very modestly. I pay all authors a little bit, and I try to support, you know, oddly enough, Tom Dispatch, which started just as a frameworks, an analysis site, whatever, partially because of the world we're in, has started doing real reporting. I mean, I've had some really good on-the-ground reporting from Afghanistan in the last few months, for instance, and I try to offer a little more money for that and so on and so forth. But I also make part of my living elsewhere as an editor. So, yes, the revenue stream, this is not – you've written this yourself, Bob. I mean, there's most places like Tom Dispatch, there's no way, there's no model for generating – the kind of revenue that would make it. I don't think. I mean, I haven't seen it. And it's not why I'm doing it. You know, it's kind of more like an obsession. So.
Yeah, if you had to depend on this to pay for your bills and put your kids through school, it wouldn't be working.
No, it would not. I mean, it would get me maybe halfway. But and that's thanks to the Nation Institute.
And thanks to public schools in that case. Tom Engelhardt, our guest. And Tom, let's turn to the issue that I think your website has covered as well or better than anywhere, print or digital, that I know of, which is Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And, I think it's an issue that gets some coverage in the mainstream news media, but sort of drifts to the margins. And I think for a lot of people, their eyes glaze over when they hear Afghanistan. They just hear Afghanistan terror. But I think a very small percent of Americans have really any idea what the heck's going on there.
I think that's true. I mean, one of the things, just to give you a simple example, one of the things that I've written about a fair amount is Obama's surge, because most people, if asked, would say 30,000 troops, $30 billion. That's basically what he said in his West Point speech. And few people would have a sense of the breadth and largeness of the actual expansion of the war that's going on. I mean, few people know that it's estimated that another 56,000 private contractors are going to go into Afghanistan in the next 18 months, or that the CIA is going to surge by 20 to 25% in that same 18 months, or it's now 17 months, or that the State Department's surging on both sides of the Afghan border, or that base building, that is military base building, has gone crazy in the last year and it's just ongoing. I mean, there are a set of, I did at one point a piece on the, I think, 9 surges that I saw. 8 plus the troop surge. And even the troop surge, for instance, people think of it as Obama's surge. But the interesting thing is that, like a lot that is Obama's foreign policy, the initial surge started at the end of the Bush administration. When Obama came in March, he sent in 21,000 troops. And then he's just sent in another 30,000. But the first 11,000 troops of the surge were sent in or okayed to be sent in at the end of the Bush administration and went in the first days of the Obama administration, 11,000 of them. So, that's the sort of thing that I do try and put together. Or to give you an example, the piece that I'm about to put up at the site tonight is on the, most people have probably seen, because it's been well covered, intelligence catastrophe in the suicide bomber mm-hmm. walked into a small forward operating base in Afghanistan near the Pakistani border, blew himself up, and blew up with him 7 CIA operatives, two of whom turned out to belong to Blackwater or Z services, and a Jordanian captain who was actually running the suicide bomber as a supposed agent. I've read through with a fellow who works with me, Nick Terse. We've read through, I don't know, hundreds of pages of these endless articles that have come out, a couple of which have been good, but which have been fine on the subject. But in them, we've been looking for details, not on this particular incident, but on the CIA's secret war in Afghanistan. And again, there's a whole other war going on in Afghanistan that involves, you know, kick the door in night raids, which are very high civilian casualties, the Predator War, that is the drones that are being sent over Pakistan, which have been escalating. It involves the CIA and Z having their own designated bases. It involves all sorts of things. There's a whole other war involving the CIA that is not basically barely discussed, not on the whole, with one or two exceptions, particularly well covered in the mainstream, you know. And yet, this is where billions of dollars are going, and it also looks like a kind of a catastrophe, probably helping to expand the war significantly.
Yeah, that point seems that you've written about two, and it seems the most important one of all, perhaps maybe not the most, but an important point, which is what exactly is a victory there, and what are the prospects that the course of Brazil now will get us to that victory?
Yes. Well, I mean, I don't even think, you know, one of the things about the Obama administration, unlike the Bush administration, is they don't even use words like victory anymore. Most of the language that we knew, global war on terror, gone. Victory, of course, that had disappeared by the end of the Bush administration. But they talk about, I mean, the Obama administration's definition of success at this point seems to be blunting the Taliban's own surge, which has been going on for the last year or two. And, you know, there's no way of knowing from this distance whether that's possible. But even if it is possible, why that would be considered a genuine success passes me by. Basically, each further escalatory step that the U.S. has taken, both in Afghanistan and probably even more seriously in Pakistan, seems to have widened the war there, and not in ways that would be particularly pleasing even to this administration. I mean, that's the way it looks from here, and yet the use of force, the continual use of more force, when it fails, one of the things that fascinates me just conceptually is that when Washington recomputes and says, this policy didn't work, we've got to come up with a new policy, the new policy is invariably just some recombination of the idea of the use of force. And so right now, for instance, they're pushing hard. The Obama administration, we know this again from news reports, that the Obama administration is pushing hard to extend the drone war and possibly other wars. They may already have been extended, as far as we know, into the Pakistani, the southern Pakistani province, border province of Baluchistan, which is kind of a hornet's nest of problems, you know, and we kind of know that if they extend the war there, that happens to be Quetta, the capital of that province, happens to be where it's at least claimed the Taliban leadership resides, or the main Taliban leadership, including possibly Mullah Omar. I have no way of knowing from here if this is true, but it is the claim. The Pakistanis have not gone after them for reasons we could discuss if you want, and the Obama administration is pushing hard for us to move on this basically inhabited area with drone attacks. And this is going to be if it actually happens, this is just going to be an incendiary thing inside of Pakistan, which is a large, unlike Afghanistan, it's a large, independent, and nuclear-armed state.
Our guest, Tom Engelhardt from TomDispatch.com, joining us today on Media Matters. We're taking telephone calls, of course, at 333-9455 or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. TomDispatch.com is a website that covers politics and foreign affairs with detailed, well-researched and edited essays, three every week. If you're not familiar with it, I think you'll enjoy reading it. Let's go back to the phone lines now to line one, Champaign County. You're on the air with Tom Engelhardt.
Hi. I'm wondering how over time you covered this secret war. You referred to the CIA's kind of
their own front and their own activity inside Afghanistan. But it seems to me the large unreported story that only gets mentioned on alternative media every now and again, and I'm wondering how you covered it, is the issue of the undeclared secret war against Iran over the years. 2 years before the end of the Bush administration, the Democrats signed on to $400 million of covert funding for destabilizing Iran, which involved the Baluchis and all sorts of different regional groups and PJAC, and as opposed to PKK. And the PKK were Turkey's enemies, so they're our enemies, and PJAC are our friends because they're attacking Iran, and they're actually brothers in arms. So all this complexity that never, ever has gotten mentioned before, and the idea that if you would just flip it around a little bit, and if somebody was paying people in Mexico to destabilize the U.S., what would the media have to say about that, and how might it affect an election in our country? My argument is that the Bush policies, which the Democrats signed on to and through that period of time, probably ensured the election of Ahmadinejad and hardliners, because when you're under attack by a superpower, hyperpower. And the other thing is, I'm wondering how you're handling, I'm looking at a Democracy Now! Headline which says, U.S.-led forces accused of executing school children in Afghanistan. Now, you don't read about this anywhere else, and people have been criticizing the drones. Even their own specialist, Kilcullen, has been saying the drone attacks are counterproductive because they alienate more people. But if it's really true that U.S. forces are actually pulling kids out of their beds and shooting them in a nighttime raid, and this isn't the CIA, this is the allegation.
No, this may in fact have been the CIA. That particular case, we don't really, as far as I can tell, quite know who did it. It's referred to euphemistically as OGA, which is other government agencies, which often is the CIA. And the CIA is often involved with special forces, evidently, in these nighttime raids. But I think it's still unclear whether it was special forces or who it was who did grab those eight kids, handcuffed at least some of them, and then executed them. The answer, let me try and answer your questions kind of one after another. The answer on what Tom Dispatch covers. Just to give you an example on civilian casualties, which is a subject I've covered regularly, and not just on Iraq as well as Afghanistan, but I believe Tom Dispatch is possibly the only site, the only place, or almost the only place, that has regularly written about one of the strange phenomenons of the Afghan war and partially the Iraq war, too, which is the slaughter from the air of wedding parties. And I've counted, I think I'd have to look back at my latest piece, but I've counted about six of them. There was one in Iraq, and there have been five, maybe six, there have been funeral parties as well. But, I mean, when people gather, this has been one of the disasters of the war, and although each wedding party that goes down is reported in the mainstream, nobody thinks to add them together. Nobody thinks to say, you know, this is a part of our war. So that's, for instance, an example of the kind of, so I think civilian, the issue of civilian, because war, we just call it war, and then we have this strange term, collateral damage. But in fact, war historically has ever more. If you really want to think about war today, any war, really, just about, it's not just American war, although it's striking an American war, soldiers are the collateral damage. In terms of the damage done, soldiers tend to be the collateral damage. It's civilians who are usually central. This was certainly true in the Iraq war. Afghanistan, it looks like it's been quite true. So that's one subject. On Iran, you do have to understand, and I know, Bob, you understand this well, Tom Dispatch is not a news service. I wish I were. I wish, you know, writers write in and say, you know, you've got to send your people out to do whatever. I have no people. You know, I mean, I have people who write for me, and if they happen to be in the right place, they cover it. So the answer is that I have covered Iran. You know, the person who really did that $400 million story on the $400 million that the Bush administration has put into to various kinds of subversions of the Iranian government was Seymour Hersh, you know. So I read that just like you do, and I do my best, again, to give some sense to the extent that I understand it, of what's going on in Iran. I have an Iran piece coming up this week from Dilip Hiro, who's a well-respected expert on Iran, on the Green Movement and what to make of it. And each piece that appears at Time Dispatch, I do a little introduction, often framing it or offering some extra information or whatever.
Tom Engelhardt, our guest, you've just been listening to today on Media Matters. And Tom, one of your recent pieces that you wrote, I thought had a striking observation in it, which was the exact price the United States has paid in the now 8-9 years since 9/11 attacks to battle Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, and how by any measure what's going on right now in the United States is exactly what bin Laden wants. I mean, he's defeating us. It's like he's on a victory lap around wherever he is, Ujiristan or wherever it is.
Yes. You know, I mean, I'm constantly in a strange way awed by the fact that we've now, by most counts, poured about $1 trillion. I think these counts are relatively unreal. I mean, it may be more, but $1 trillion into our wars. You know, it's funny. One of the things that strikes me in news coverage is that it's very seldom that there's any connection made between our economic situation, the economic collapse or anything else, and the money that we pour into that world of the military and into our permanent state of wars. So I think if you had told Osama bin Laden on September 10th, 2001, that the result of this attack, the attack of September 11th, would be that the U.S. would pour $1 trillion into wars against, in essence, his outfit and then other places because of what had been triggered, I think he would have considered it a remarkable victory, particularly knowing that the estimates for the Afghan war now are that if we keep on going with this for any number of years, which it looks like we're going to, you're talking another $1 trillion just for Afghanistan. They figure about a decade, $1 trillion. And I noticed the other day, for instance, that our Afghan war commander, Stanley McChrystal, is putting together a dedicated group of people, military officers, hundreds of them, who are to spend the next 5 years of their career focused on particularly on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, what interests me about that, there have been a number of news stories about that, but what strikes me is nobody comments on that 5 years. This is why the mainstream press is kind of the gift that keeps giving for me, because there's all this information that's never kind of, you know, it's kind of in there, but nobody ever comments on it or really thinks about it. And yet, if the military, whatever the Obama administration claims to be doing, if the military is thinking in at least a five-year horizon, you know something that's actually quite interesting. You know that they're thinking 5 years of this war, that they're thinking that's the realistic thing, at least.
Now, one of the wars that's fallen off the news pages has been Iraq, which was, of course, the big war for most of the last decade. And it's sort of strange the way we talk about wars now, like we talk about baseball standings.
Yeah.
And is the Iraq war pretty much done now? Or are we pretty much through there? Is that we wrap that baby up?
this is such a good question and one I follow and write about but can't really answer. I mean, you know, the Bush administration, again, Obama policy is basically Bush administration policy from the last moments of the Bush administration. They made an agreement with the Iraq government in which they would get so-called combat troops, which is a very strange category. It's one of those categories that you can constantly redefine. I mean, any combat troop, and every troop is in a way a soldier, is a combat soldier, but they define certain of them as combat troops. That combat troops, maybe about 50,000 of them, are supposed to be out by this August, and all the rest of U.S. forces are supposed to be out by 2011. However, one of the things that I tend to follow air power a lot, and one of the interesting things about Iraq is that we dismantled the Iraqi army, and that's often been discussed. The Iraqi Air Force also was gone, and we've functionally never rebuilt it. Now, just recently, we've started doing some things, but there basically is no Iraqi. There has been no Iraqi Air Force. There is, on the other hand, a huge American base at Balad, somewhere north of Baghdad, as big as, like, it has traffic like Chicago's O'Hare Airport, they say. I think since the Iraqis are not going to have an Air Force for the foreseeable future, that we are not going to see the Americans leaving in 2011. I mean, I don't know how many will, how far it will draw down. The Bush administration's plan always from the beginning was to draw down to about 30,000 troops and have them stationed on slightly faraway bases and basically garrison the place forever. And Gates has just recently, that's Secretary of Defense Gates, has recently begun talking about the fact that the Iraqis might actually want us to stay beyond 2011. So my answer is that at the American level, the war, I think it's very unlikely the war will be, the occupation, let's say, will be over in 2011. The situation in Iraq is also rather unsettled, and so I think it will remain so.
I would like to monopolize you for the rest of the show, but it would be unfair to the listeners, especially those who want to call in and speak with Tom Engelhardt. The number 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now to a very patient caller. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hello. One aspect of the Afghan war I find gives America a real low probability of winning is the aspect of eradicating the poppy fields and substituting crops. I heard on public radio that 50% of the Afghanis grow it, and as much as 80% of the inhabitants profit by it. And probably most of the farmers are addicts too. So if you were a farmer there and the Americans came by and destroyed your crop, and not only did you lose your finances, they want you to substitute wheat, which is $5-6 a bushel, as opposed to the opium, which is probably $100 an ounce or more. Not only do they destroy your livelihood, but they also wreak havoc on your habit. How can you expect to win the war when you do that to the citizenry? I'll hang up. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Tom?
I mean, it's a very interesting statement. I can't answer it. I mean, Afghanistan is, it's really the planet's, probably the planet's leading narco state. I mean, I think the figures I've seen on the opium, the heroin, its supplies to the world, 90-odd%. So there's almost no way to pry Afghanistan loose from these drugs or the growing of these drugs. I can't imagine. And I think, in fact, that the Obama administration has given up and changed its policy on that. As far as I know, they are no longer actively trying to significantly eradicate, wipe out poppy fields. I think they've really given up. The coverage of this is not strong. I'm hoping to have a piece on this sometime in February. It's a subject that I'm most interested in. I only wish I knew more. But, for instance, Tom Dispatch had a piece. There's a woman who writes for the site who worked for humanitarian organizations in Afghanistan for a number of years, Ann Jones. She's a wonderful writer. She wrote a book called Kabul in Winter, a beautiful book. And she was back there recently, and she attached herself to the U.S. military trainers training the Afghan army. And she was reporters don't do this. You know, it's not considered kinetic. That is, they're not out there with it's not the action. But, you know, she went out there and she watched the Afghan army being trained. And when she was done, she actually wondered whether there was much of an Afghan army. She thinks the Afghan army may be something of a figment of our imagination. I mean, there are some Afghan. We're clearly training a lot of people, some of whom probably are actually Taliban recruits being trained. It's a meal ticket, but the desertion rates are so high. She said she was watching Afghan soldiers in the middle of the summer in the heat. They were on a field, and they were wearing their uniforms. These were recruits being trained by Americans. And under the uniforms, they were wearing these gym suits that the Americans had given them so that they'd evidently do physical exercise in their spare time. But they clearly couldn't afford to leave them in their barracks, where they were afraid they would be stolen. So they were out in the boiling sun with these double suits on. You know, and a lot of them are malnourished. They're illiterate. The idea, which is, of course, the idea of the surge, that we're going to hire someplace like, it looks like maybe one possible hiree is Blackwater or Z, one of these private firms, and the U.S. military to train up, 190,000-man Iraqi army. I mean, this is like a very strange idea. and a pretty unlikely idea. And if we succeeded in it, because because the Afghans really have next to no money, if we train that army, that's ours. We pay for that for the next 10 or 15 years. There's no one else to pay for an army of that size for Afghanistan. It's just not going to happen. So it seems like a strange, woebegone, and dangerous mission.
Yeah, I don't want to dwell on this, Tom Engelhardt, but as you're talking now and as I read about Afghanistan and as I see no sort of optimistic end picture even by the people pursuing this war in Washington, it reminds me of the tapes of Lyndon Johnson's White House that came available within the last 10 years that showed before he escalated the war in Vietnam, in his private conversations in the Oval Office, he acknowledged that the United States could never win there.
Yes.
And, you know, it's chilling when you read the transcripts because he's basically saying, you know we don't have a chance here. Ultimately, the side we're supporting has really little popular support, and ultimately the other side knows we're going to have to leave at some point, and they'll still be there, and we're going to lose. Yet he still pursued the war.
You know, what makes this even eerier is that we know that the Obama White House, including the president, was reading a book about the Vietnam disaster while they were making this decision. It was a book about, you know, it was a book about exactly this subject, how we kind of ended up stumbling into the full-scale Vietnam war. And they were reading this book. It's quite a striking and critical book as they were making this decision. So at some level, they have to know that this is not that they're in a tough. They must know this, and yet, you know, I just think that Washington cannot imagine at this point, you know, as in many situations in Washington, they can't imagine another solution.
Growing up in the 60s, as I did, the 50s, yeah, as you did, and through the 70s and 80s, to refer to the United States as an empire was something that was not done very frequently. And if you did it, it earmarked you as sort of a kook or dissident or malcontent. In the past decade, that's really changed.
Well, you know, the first people to change it in many ways were not on the left. You know, in their great moment, the neocons, you know, the people around Bush, the people who people like, say, columnist Charles Krauthammer, they began talking about us. As they began comparing us, what they really began doing was comparing us to Rome and the British Empire and saying, you know, we were greater. And mm-hmm. And it was a period that passed fairly quickly, a couple of years. But I think to some extent, I mean, it's not on the left. People have been certainly saying empire over the years. I mean, I agree. Back in the 60s, you just didn't think this until deep into the Vietnam War, even if you were anti-war. But in our period, this briefly became kind of a trope of the right, and then of course when everything turned to disaster they went silent on the subject, but empire, I think, became, it was cleansed briefly.
And you've done a lot of work on it, and the question I have for you is, it seems to be, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, it seems to be that this is the extent to which the United States is a militaristic nation, the extent of our militarism and our imperial obligations and the implications for our society domestically and economically and socially and politically and civil liberties and on and on and on, are almost not discussed at all.
Yes.
You've published Chalmers Johnson's books. He's been a guest in this program several times, every time he has a new book out. Is there a day of reckoning that, you know, can you go on and on having this sort of massive global empire on one hand and then sort of not even noticing it domestically otherwise?
Yes, I think sooner. I mean, it's so hard because the future is unknown, but yes, I it seems almost impossible to imagine that sooner or later. Now, what that day of reckoning will be, because if you don't recognize what you're doing, then when that day of reckoning comes, you may not react. I mean, this is really the story of the post-9/11 world. This is the story. This is what Chalmers was writing about, you know, with blowback, which is that the thing about blowback is the idea of blowback, it was a CIA tradecraft term of the trade, was a covert operation that Americans didn't know about, so that if somehow it blew back on the United States, Americans had no way of placing the blame where it lay. And this is one of the problems, I think, that we may see when the, you know, the our military, our Pentagon, our Pentagonized society kind of comes home to roost, which is that the explanations will be found elsewhere. And yet, I'll tell you a funny story about Chalmers. I was struck by it because he's written a lot at Tom Dispatch about what he calls our empire of bases. And in his second book of his blowback trilogy, The Sorrows of Empire, the whole central part of that second book for chapters is really laying out our empire bases, the 800-odd bases that we have and the ones we don't mention and so on and so forth. This is extraordinary. There's no other example of this in history, period. That is only bases abroad, not bases in the United States. And when that book came out, he was already well-known, blowback had hit, and the book was reviewed widely and well, and generally positively, and yet in the period of the first year of that book's review, no reviewer dealt with the central subject of the book, which was the empire of bases. It took a Brit, a Guardian reporter writing for the New York Review of Books, about a year and a half later, to actually bring up the subject. And I found that fascinating. I mean, there is a level of denial about militarism, about the centrality of the Pentagon, about our global bases, about the fact that we now, and this really, even in the 60s, this was something we wouldn't have believed, we now fight perpetual war. War never ends. You know? I mean, I was just writing about this for this Sunday for the CIA piece, and I start out with the fact, I mean, in war, you need secrecy. That makes sense. I mean, it's very logical. But what happens when war time never ends and secrecy simply becomes a way of life and actually a fairly profitable way of life? I mean, this is just a problem of our world that on the whole, and Chalmers Johnson broke through this in his books, mostly, though, Americans don't like to think much about this or to connect it to their world or their lives unless somebody's going to shut down a military base near them and then people go crazy.
Well, James Madison, in one of his most prophetic observations, noted that a nation that was constantly at war was no longer going to be free in short order.
Yes.
Not long order.
Yeah.
Exactly. Tom Engelhardt, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. And as a note to listeners who have been following the program closely, my co-author John Nichols and I will be on now with David Brancaccio this Friday night. So try to tune us in if you're interested in the subject of journalism, which we'll be talking about. We've only got a few minutes left with you, Tom, and I'd like to sort of
just
switch.
Just before you say, I just want to break in and say, by the way, that I'm reading your new book, which is really interesting. I recommend it highly.
Well, coming from you, that's high praise, especially from an editor, which I'm always cautious when an editor reads one of my books. And thank you very much. But let's turn to the page now, Tom, to a little bit of your own life and your view of our nation. I'm interested in getting your observations. I've read your interviews with you about your history coming through the 60s and 70s. And going into editing, and just sort of your sense of how this country has changed from when you were a young man, and for the better and for the worse, and you know, where you think we are today as a country.
Wow. I think maybe the most striking thing to me today, I mean, I don't know if it's the most striking thing at this second. One of the problems with radio, unlike writing, is you can't sit down and think, you know, and redo your thoughts. But I'm struck when we were growing up, even if you had gone into opposition, you were still much closer to a tradition, a feeling that the government, probably coming out of the New Deal era, that the government, you know, potentially, if it wasn't on your side, it could be. And a feeling that the government could be yours, and consequently, and that this and various ideas about what a democracy was and so on and so forth. I mean, I find particularly with young people I'm 65, so when I say a kid, I don't know, somebody in his 20s recently, just talk about the government as the bureaucracy. I step back, I thought, I mean, it's true, it is a giant broken bureaucracy. I don't disagree rationally, but I still was struck, because he was saying he was thinking about whether to someday to take a job in the bureaucracy, and I never would have called it that. So, I mean, one major thing is we were, in our mythology, if not in the reality of our lives, we were closer to, still a belief in an American democratic tradition, to the possibility that government could do things for you. And more than that, I think that you could do something for government. I mean, the idea of civic duty. I mean, kids today, I think, they're doing all sorts of things for individuals, and I mean, it's not that they're not giving, it's not that they're not volunteering, but the idea, the larger idea of civic duty, I see less of that. And I see, you know, I say that partially because in a funny way, if asked about Tom Dispatch, I would say that it's some part, it just feels like some part of a long-delayed civic duty for me. I feel like that's why I'm doing it to some extent, so... I mean, those are just a couple of observations. I don't know if that's what you had in mind.
Well, I guess I'd give you a B+, but there wasn't really a correct answer on that. really, what I'm interested too is, you know, in reading your website and your own pieces too, is the notion of the United States as a nation in decline. And I think that certainly wasn't the feeling in the 1960s.
No. I've argued for a long time, and I'm not original in this. I don't mean to, you know, others did it before me. But at the site, I've argued almost from the beginning that the Cold War didn't have a victor and a vanquished. It actually had two defeated countries. It's just that the defeated empires, you might say. It's just that the bigger, the stronger, the wealthier of the two was heading for the exit much, much more slowly. And I think we do see that. I think that's clearer now. And when you talked earlier about the day of reckoning, I mean, that is, if you want to talk about a day of reckoning, you know, assumedly there will come a point, whether it's 10 or 20 years down the line, whatever it is, where, you know, it just isn't possible. No matter the superstructure we've built, it isn't possible to simply conduct perpetual wars, you know, on places that are almost as far away as the moon. I mean, when you look at Afghanistan, one of the stunning things is how much it costs to get anything there. You know, I mean, I mean, to me, I've never understood. This would put me in a category. You know, I'm no isolationist, but I have never understood. I have always believed we could have locked our cockpit doors, and we could have done much better things with our money, and we would have been much safer, and that we never should have fought a war in Afghanistan, and that you, in fact, can't fight a war against an organization like Al-Qaeda, because it's not a state, it's not something that you join like an army, it's not something that you can simply crush, it's a set of ideas. I mean, when you come right down to it, many of them may be disturbing ideas, but that's functionally what it is.
Tom, we've only got 2 minutes left or so. Are there on the horizon right now hopeful signs in the United States of either politicians or groups that are moving in a direction you think that's trying to, like, take the United States in a sustainable and more humane direction that give you hope? And you're allowed to be despondent.
I might just be despondent. I mean, let me say I'm always, you know, I have a great belief in the surprises of history, and in that sense I'm always hopeful. But at this moment, I could certainly come up with some groups that I think are doing good work and so on and so forth. But generally speaking, I do think we're dealing with a remarkably broken, vast and broken government, and a mindset in Washington in relation to the world that's catastrophic, and I don't see at this point a heck of a way out of it.
But you're going to keep reporting on it for
us. Oh yes. I'd like to say that I'm obsessive, and so if you read Tom Dispatch, you're functionally an addict. But there we are.
Well, it's a website I recommend to everyone, TomDispatch.com. Our guest today on Media Matters, joining us for the full hour, has been Tom Engelhardt, discussing it and what the site covers. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Bob, thanks a lot. It was great.
Good luck with the site.
Thank you.
And I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, Kyle Kroha, the engineer, for their great work. I'll be back in 167 hours. We're going to have the long-awaited interview with Robin Kelly about Thelonious Monk. Until then, everyone, have a great week. Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, bitterly cold and mostly sunny today with a high around 18. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a temperature around 15 degrees. Tomorrow, cloudy with a 40% chance of snow, a high reaching 25. Monday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of flurries, a low around 14. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2.